The first time I ever heard the term Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem was shortly after we moved to Yellowstone, and we ended up living next door to John Townsley, the then superintendent. And one night, he came out and we were having popcorn and a beer on the picnic table between our homes, and he said, "Let me tell you where I've just been." And a week earlier, Townsley had gone to Cody to testify at a hearing about a proposal that Secretary of the Interior Jim Watt, who you all remember, decided to open the Washakie Wilderness, 39,000 acres of the Washakie Wilderness, to oil and gas exploration. And Townsley went over and stood up and said, "Let me tell you, we've only got a few bears left, and we know that at least 16 of them are standing in the Washakie. We're opposed to that." The next day, he got a call from Jim Watt and said, "I want you in Washington." This was in Tuesday. "I want you in Washington on Thursday." He went, and Watt told him, "You are the superintendent of that park. Don't you ever set foot outside that park and talk about what happens with resource matters outside of your park." He told me that night, "You know, it's time that we be thinking in terms of a greater Yellowstone ecosystem." First time I'd ever heard that term. I'm not sure where he got it, but he went on and said, "Someone ought to write a book about this." And so that started me on this journey into the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, how one would define it, what it means to us. I immediately discovered that it was one of the last intact major ecosystems left in the temperate zones of the earth. And that got my attention, and so away we went. Now, Todd, who has been following Greater Yellowstone things for at least 30 years since you came out of the streets of Chicago, brought forth this idea of a mountain journal that would focus on Greater Yellowstone ecosystem issues. So early on, Mike and Todd and I met. Our power as a board, our influence as a board, our capabilities as a board were vastly enhanced when Paula came to the board and Lisa Beekman. And as it turns out, these two females are powerhouses, and we wouldn't be where we are today without them. I was going to talk about the concept of ecosystem. I was going to talk about the concept of a greater yellow ecosystem. I don't think I'll do that, but I would like to take just 2 minutes before I finish at this thing up here. And I don't need the mic up there, I don't think. The Greater Yellowstone ecosystem, as we know it today, is roughly 20 million acres. But it extends really from Bozeman on the north, all the way down to Lander, all the way down to Lander on the south, to Cody on the east, way over into Island Park in Idaho on the west. And if you think about it in at least two major ways, one, what I call Greater Yellowstone headwaters. The highest ride the Continental Divide up here, where Montana, Idaho, or near a point where Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming converge. The first waters of the Yellowstone, the Snake, and the Green Rivers are born right there in Greater Yellowstone. In addition to that, think about headwaters in the Greater Yellowstone, starting from over here, north and west of Bozeman. We have the Madison, the Ruby, the Gallatin, the Yellowstone, the Boulder, the Stillwater, and the Rosebud. Come over to this side and down a little bit to the south. We have the Lamar, the Clarksport, the Shoshone, the Grey Bull, the Wind River. come down here and back across to the southwest. Those rivers include the Green, the Salt, the Snake, the Gros Ventre, and the Henry's Fork. They all arise in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. They don't all arise in Yellowstone Park. That's why this concept of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem is so important. The park itself, along with Grand Teton, those two parks themselves comprise only 15% of the total area of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. But elsewhere in that area are 6 national forests, 12 designated wilderness areas, and those wilderness areas, though, together comprise more than 4 million acres. And then the Teton, the Custer, Gallatin, the Shoshone, the Teton, the Caribou, the Beaverhead, and the Targhee National Forests. So that's what we're talking about here. The problem we have is the greater Yellowstone ecosystem spans an area that is controlled in part by the state of Wyoming, in part by the state of Idaho, in part by the state of Montana. It encompasses 16 counties and large expanses of private land. It's still 75% public land. You can imagine the difficulty of getting everybody from 16 counties to 3 states and 12 agencies going in the right direction. And that has been the challenge. And in some ways, we've come a long way since then. In some ways, we haven't moved off of square one. So that's my deal. Thanks, Tom.
I've been a journalist for 30 years. I'm going to be speaking today as both a journalist and as a Bozeman citizen. So one of my points of frustration is we get mired down in these fragmented issues, and we don't behold the big picture. So Mountain Journal is not about covering city commission meetings. It is not about covering school board meetings. It is about taking a 30,000-foot view at this place that we call home. So some parts of the country, they call themselves Salmon Nation. We could call ourselves Yellowstone Nation, or in particular, Greater Yellowstone Nation, or we could call ourselves Grizzly Nation, or Elk Nation, or Bison Nation, or Pronghorn Nation. I could go down a list, and what we have here that no other place in the lower 48 has is all of our major mammals here and all of our major wildlife here. So when Rick talks about this place, we used to think of Greater Yellowstone from the point of view of mountain ranges and watersheds, but we become far more sophisticated in the way we think about it in terms of the organic functions on landscape. And so what I want you to think about here and meditate on is this place doesn't exist anywhere else. There is no other Greater Yellowstone ecosystem over the next mountain range. This is it. This is our national treasure. This is our version of the Serengeti. This is the reference point that the world makes in the richest nation in its wild backyard. And so here's our Humbleville. You know, we are the capital city of Greater Yellowstone. We're on the northern flank of Greater Yellowstone, Bozeman, Montana. You know, there was a city commission meeting a couple nights ago. There was a candidates forum, and one of the city commissioners talked about a growth plan and talked about a growth mentality that was put in place in the 1980s. Nobody in the early 1980s could have imagined Bozeman today or what its competitive advantage in the world was then. We were on the verge of losing grizzly bears. We didn't have wolves. Now we've got wolves out in the Southern Valley here. We have people from around the world that are coming here, spending $1 billion a year just in Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Park. So you talk about the connection between nature and economy. And again, so we think about this place. There is really a regional identity here, and it's becoming solidified. And thanks to people like Rick Reese, who wrote the first book ever on Greater Yellowstone, we think about it. We have a lot of similarities, despite the fact that our residency transcends three different states that are very different politically, very different culturally, and yet we connect. We connect with this focal point here. We make pilgrimages there. So I talked about the organic function of Greater Yellowstone. This is what sets us apart. So look at this. Elk migrations. Each one of these is a different colored elk migration. Think about this. And most of them have some sort of connection to Yellowstone National Park proper. If you go to mountainjournal.org, you're going to be reading a long series that I'm in the middle of on chronic wasting disease. And the elk feed grounds in Wyoming that are set up to have chronic wasting disease infect those herds. And those elk summer here, and they mix, and those mix here. We've got a brucellosis problem. Some people believe it was exacerbated by a high rate of brucellosis there. So we are connected. We are biologically interconnected by rivers and mountains and elk. So it's one of the reasons Bozeman is so popular, says Penelope Pierce. Many of you know her from work with the Gallatin Valley Land Trust. Because we do have wildlife that people can see, because we're protecting wildlife habitat with these projects. And also scenic vistas. People come to Montana because they want to see big, wild, open spaces. But imagine Bozeman in the middle of the High Plains. We would not be this community. We are here. We are all of us here because of the wildlife. And if you're not here because of wildlife, I don't know why you're here. Yeah. It isn't any place, USA. Within the past few years, I've been writing about this place, and I started to have an epiphany talking with some folks. Dennis Glick from Future West is here, and one of his colleagues is Randy Carpenter, who's a population natural resource demographer. Randy's been working all over the place. One of the places he's been working with is in southern Wyoming in the upper Green River Valley, a boom town, Pinedale, Wyoming, one of the epicenters for fracking. And so Randy and I have had lots of talks over the years, and this is my crude map. This is what we think of, and I want you to think about these different places on the map, because I'll get to them in a second. So again, the twin pistons in Greater Yellowstone are Bozeman and Jackson. I was once a Jacksonite. I moved to Jackson. It was the first place that I settled when I left Chicago. I'm from Minneapolis originally. And so these are the two, these drive everything. Teton County, Wyoming, around Jackson, the richest per capita county in the country. Whoa. If you want to talk about haves and have-nots and affordable housing, you have people that are making 50-mile commutes in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem so that they can become service workers in the mega mansions in Jackson Hole. And Jackson says, we don't want to be like Aspen and Vail. Well, I don't think we want to be like Jackson. So, according to our local newspaper, again, I'm a journalist, we're going to talk about facts, not alternative facts today. But according to our local newspaper, based on a story, the projections are that Little Bozeman, Montana, 50,000, 100,000+ in Gallatin County, that by 2060 we're going to hit 145,000. How many people think that's a lot of people? Raise your hand. Okay. So, if that statistic is floated out in our biggest, most widely circulated newspaper, and that becomes the reference point for thinking about growth and framing it up, let's talk about that a little bit. 145,000 people by 2060. Remember that, right? So, Randy Carpenter, if you're an investor or if you're a population demographer, you know the rule of 72. What's the rule of 72? The rule of 72 is you divide an interest rate of return, or you divide in a population's growth rate into 72, and you get the number of years it'll take your investment to double, or the number of years it'll take a population to double. So 72 divided by X. Six takeaways from the Prospera annual report. Bozeman is going to be 145,000 people in 2060. That's calculated at a 0.8% growth rate. 0.8%. Here's our quaint little bill. Gallatin County's actually growing at 3%, not 0.8%, and it will hit 208,000 people in 24 years of the year 2041. So if you are a city or county official and you're basing the growth rate on 0.8%, how is your calculation of what's going on and who's paying for the costs of growth? How is that different? In fact, Gallatin County isn't growing at 3%, it's growing at 4%. We will reach 208,000 in 18 years or 2035. This isn't alternative facts. This is Salt Lake City proper. Not Salt Lake City Metro, Salt Lake City proper. It's about the size of Salt Lake City. That's the number of people. I just want you to think about that. We'll get to spatial dimensions in a minute. Bozeman's the fastest growing community in the U.S. per capita. Greater Yellowstone is the fastest growing rural region in the country, the 20 counties. People are coming here. In the early 1980s, those planners who plotted out Bozeman's future, they couldn't have imagined this. They thought we were going to ride booms and busts out forever. Not true. Another fact from Headwaters Economics and Ray Rasker. What we're being inundated with are people with expendable income. Money derived from investment income is one of the biggest economic engines here. We've got baby boomers who are retiring, and they're moving. So Gallatin County, actually, 104,000 people. Bozeman proper is actually growing faster than 4%. So Gallatin County is growing from 104,000. If you double this again, 416,000 people in 36 years, or at 2053, we become 416,000 people. You say it's impossible? If any of you have been to Mesa, Arizona, or Aurora, Colorado, it's true that they have major urban areas there, but I'll get to that in a minute. So here's our quaint little town. Minneapolis proper. This is Minneapolis sized. Minneapolis proper, not the metro area, so I want to disabuse people who think I'm referring to my homeland, the Twin Cities. I'm referring to Minneapolis proper. So you look at Minneapolis proper, north to south, east to west. So north to south of Minneapolis proper is roughly equivalent of going from Gallatin Gateway to Manhattan. So you think of 400,000 people packed in north to south. I'm just as a reference, the Gallatin Valley's a hell of a lot bigger than this. You look at Bozeman, you go west out past Churchill, Manhattan, probably to the Missouri, or to the Madison. Gallatin Valley's a lot bigger than that. We have different cities and towns out there, but the valley's rapidly filling in, and I would encourage any of you who don't believe that to take a Sunday drive out on a back road, and you will discover subdivisions, and you will say, how the heck did these get here, and when did they arrive? So Gallatin County, at 4%, will reach 416,000 in 36 years, not 145,000 in 2060. These are not alternative facts. This is the truth. This is reality. So what are we going to do about this? Three times the growth rate that was reported in the local newspaper. It means that you plan differently, if that's the case. Again, our quaint little town. Our town that we want to think will remain this way forever. The capital city of Greater Yellowstone. What happens in Bozeman doesn't stay in Bozeman. What happens in Bozeman affects this miracle called the Madison Valley and the Paradise Valley. If you want to hear about growth in Bozeman, talk to Dennis Blick and the good people in Livingston. You know what they say? We don't want to be like Bozeman. Jackson Hole down here. I'll talk about this in a minute, but you've got these high growth corridor from Idaho Falls to Rexburg over to Jackson and down. Jackson Hole, Wyoming, 3% of the land is private, 98% is government owned. So you think about the difference here of private property versus public in the Gallatin. We have a lot of Jackson Hole refugees up here today. So what does this look like in practical terms? Remember the map of Greater Yellowstone? So you've got Bozeman in half a century, in the middle of this century, equaling Minneapolis. That corridor that I just talked about, Idaho Falls to Teton Valley and down to Star Valley, you've got a Salt Lake City-sized sprawl. 400,000 people, roughly 400-440 in Greater Yellowstone, permanent residents. Record visitation to the national parks. Plus we have people who are permanently living here. So you look at Livingston. Livingston, by the middle of this century, fills up with enough people to equal Bozeman today. You look at the spillover. You've got Big Sky tucked up there. You've got the Jack Creek Road that's closed. You've got a population that's built in a high fire area. Those people are going to demand an exit strategy instead of coming out east from the Gallatin. And when the Jack Creek Road opens, if it opens, it's going to open up a corridor between Ennis and Big Sky. You're going to have a Jackson Hole-sized population there. Cody, this little quaint corridor, that becomes Bozeman-sized. Billings, Montana, 165,000 people. By the middle of this century, 50 years or so, you could have 800,000 people from here, the headwaters that Rick talked about, to the other side of Billings. 400,000 people in all of Greater Yellowstone today, you could have twice as many in that corridor. Remember, this is the growth rate today. This is not other sort of external factors, which I'll get to. So imagine this hand-drawn map, and you think about those elk migrations that I talked about. One of the things that carries biomass around the ecosystem and supports predator and prey populations. It affects everything. There it is. So you go back, you lay that on top of this. We have great work by the Galton County Land or Galton Valley Land Trust. They're doing great work, but they're not keeping pace for growth, nor is the Jackson Hole Land Trust. So, what are those externalities, those external factors? This is the result of Hurricane Harvey in Houston. We had the Gulf Coast hammered with hurricanes this year. If you lived out along the Gallatin River and you had 100-year floods hitting your house, would you continue to rebuild? Would the insurance industry favor you to do that? At what point do rising seas and hurricanes with tidal surges At what point does the insurance industry, do they just say, we're not going to pay for you to rebuild anymore? The bigger question, though, is, apart from the normal growth rate, where are people going to go? Tens of millions of people along the coasts. We haven't even spoken about environmental refugees. Some people won't go there, but I can guarantee you that when Rick Reese talks about the headwaters of three major rivers and all of those things, they're going to go, ironically, to where the water is. They're going to escape the salt water, and they're going to go to the fresh water. They're going to go, apart from, it's another Randy Carpenter stat, apart from those little rumbling earthquakes that we have, and apart from this hyperbole that the caldera is going to blow, we are one of the safest places to live in the country. And then you've got climate change. You have Kathy Whitlock and her crew at MSU that just talked about rising temperatures. How is that going to affect the carrying capacity of the ecosystem? How is that going to affect everything that we know and love that's dependent upon water here? Our fly fishing economy. Our downhill skiing economy. Our ability to water our lawns. Phoenix will be almost unlivable by 2050. Not hit by rising seas, it's going to be hit by rising temperatures. 3 to 5 degrees on average hotter, the number of 100 plus degree temperature days rising from 40 to 132. What happens when the water runs out in Phoenix and Tucson and Las Vegas and the California desert? Where are people going to go? They're going to go to where the water is. New York City, temperatures rising from 100 degree days from 2 to 15. Where are people going to go when they want to get out of that stuff? It doesn't take a lot of people, hiccuping a lot of Americans in a population, a country with 310 million people. It doesn't take a lot of people, when you think about it, to transform an ecosystem or a community like Bozeman. This is Highlight. This is where we get our water. By the year 2036, or when Bozeman reaches a population of 62,000, whichever comes first, the population of the city will outstrip the capacity of its existing water supply that takes the form of three reservoirs. These are not alternative facts. This is written into city planning documents. You saw the numbers, you heard the numbers. Bozeman already is sailing through 50,000 and could reach 62,000 early in the 2020s, a full decade ahead of that prediction. So where are we going to get water? Are we going to start pumping groundwater? And are we going to start pumping groundwater from areas where Gallatin County has had lenient regulations, actually, pertaining to sewage disposal with sewage leach fields? If I were living downgrade out there in the gravel pits on the way to the airport, I would not be comfortable living, drawing my water from places of subdivisions that are on heap leach. What are we going to do? Who's going to pay for those? Who's going to pay for, if there's contaminated water, who's going to pay for the hookup? This is where growth doesn't pay for itself. It's great to have freedom and liberty. I'm all for it. But I don't like paying for other people's profits. The water needs of the next 50,000 people cannot be accommodated with the practices that supplied the first 45,000. So who's going to pay for the new water supplies? What happens to all these side draws if we choose not to pump groundwater that we love? Are we going to put a dam up every draw? Is that what we're going to do? I don't know. And what happens to this? The very reason we're here, wildlife, the very thing that supports predator populations. Some people like to go out and hunt. What's going to happen to this? This is another Randy Carpenter thing. Think about Greater Yellowstone. If growth rate in Greater Yellowstone of the past 30 years continues, the overall population of Greater Yellowstone region is expected to surge in just 13 years' time. 13 years. 100,000 new homes out there in Greater Yellowstone. So that would be like the equivalent of a new home for every resident in Gallatin County right now dispersed around our ecosystem. Are we going to be able to maintain the specialness of this place in the face of that? I kind of use the analogy of it's like an asteroid coming in. We need to divert it a couple of degrees to avoid it from hitting us. And people say we're going to grow. Yeah, we're going to grow. Nobody here is anti-growth. You can't shut the door. But good growth is better than bad growth. And good growth means that growth pays its way. It means we don't subsidize the profits of others. That's only fair. Remember I mentioned the upper green. This is a complex of the Pinedale Anticline and Jonah Field. This is where fracking occurred. So this is a place where pronghorn have to migrate through. There's an initiative called Path of the Pronghorn to protect the corridor. The good news about this is that you can attempt to restore the land once all the gas has been pumped out. This stuff doesn't go away ever. Around Bozeman, we have more people than ever before who are building into the wildland-urban interface throughout Greater Yellowstone, and they expect the Forest Service to come in and repel the fires that are coming in. They want to live next to the forest. They're displacing wildlife. Dennis Glick has said, if you love the Wild West, live in town. I'm not casting aspersions, but I'm just talking about expectations. The U.S. Forest Service now spends as much on firefighting as it does on all of the rest of its programs. So when a firefighter is dispatched to go save a home, that's one less biologist in the field studying elk migrations or water or a ranger meeting you on a trail or improving a trail. There are consequences to that. Again, what happens to this? So, my sidekick in crime at Mountain Journal came up with this. Remember Teton County, 3% buildable land, 97%. What's happening is a lot of development's getting pushed to the west side of the Tetons. This is Teton Valley. And he asserted a downtown Salt Lake just for a fact. Bozeman, Montana. So what amazes me is that, A, people don't have a sense of humor and can't laugh at this. And two, they take it literally. After this thing, I would encourage you to go read the growth piece at mountainjournal.org. I got all these emails and they said, you're not going to have an IDS center in Bozeman right at the end of the Bridgers. And it's like, come on, man. Don't take it literally. Can you understand a metaphor here? Minneapolis-sized in Bozeman, Montana, at a 4% growth rate that doesn't include environmental refugees. One of the limiting factors could be water, but if we're worried about water, we're going to be worried about a lot of other stuff. There's going to be unrest in the country. Our economy will be tanked. You know, at some point, all of these farmers in Gallatin County are going to wise up just like the orange grove growers in Southern California did, and they're going to realize that real estate is worth far more than growing wheat and alfalfa. And at that point, it's going to accelerate all the more. So anyway, this is what we're trying to do, is we're trying to foster a dialogue, a discussion. This is my town. A lot of you are my elders here, and I'm grateful to live in a community with you. But we really need to be talking about this stuff instead of sleepwalking through this and being anesthetized by our gadgets and everything else, because we have a decision in how we're going to grow here. Anyway, if there are any questions here, I'd be grateful, Rick, if you could come up. So there is no fair and balanced journalism when it comes to climate change. You don't quote someone who disbelieves and say that that's tantamount to what the scientific consensus is and what we're seeing on the ground. I mean, with climate change, we have massive, unprecedented beetle kills going on that have killed whitebark pine trees, and they are having behavior in grizzly bears. Whether it's human cause or not, you can argue that, but you can't argue that there's no climate change. So what's the difference between independent journalism, citizen-supported journalism, public interest journalism, and what we're doing? Listen, I lament the fact that the handheld newspapers have gone away. I loved growing up and having that tactile feel. I love having books in my hand. But whether we like it or not, it doesn't matter. You know what? Most people reading Mountain Journal, 80% of the people, I don't like this fact, 80% of the people, their first point of contact is on their cell phone. I don't like that. But whether I liked being a blacksmith in 1890 and didn't want cars to come, I didn't really have a lot of say in that. And so the media landscape has changed. And, you know, God bless the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, because the advertising model does not work anymore. It doesn't support a top-heavy staff like that. It doesn't. I wish that I could change that, but it's a fact. Every print publication, with the exception of a few now, are in trouble. And, you know, print journalism, as we've known it, is the blacksmith of the 1890s. So what we can do at Mountain Journal is we can reach the world. We have as much power, hypothetically, to reach everybody on the planet who has a cell phone. It's something that network TV didn't do. And so what we want to do is we want to have a site that resonates not only with us Greater Yellowstonians and Bozemanians, but for people who love this place and can learn lessons, places that, like the Serengeti, you know what, they're watching us to see how we deal with coexistence here. So we have a way to reach the world. As far as fair and balance goes, one of the problems in this alternative fact era is where facts and alternative facts become tantamount. You know what? It's just such rubbish. You know, science is deeply flawed, but peer-reviewed science is the best thing we have out there. It's why we're all alive here with medicine, by the way. It's why we have food safety. It's why we have a banking system that's reliable. Everything that's been peer-reviewed, and a lot of the biological stuff has gone through the National Academies of Sciences. And if you're going to base decisions based on windshield biology, if you're going to say that's equivalent to science, you know, I would encourage you that instead of going to the doctor, go to the one who says you should be involved with bloodletting. So, you know, part of the problem is, and I'll go back to my City News days, there was a mantra there, if your mother says she loves you, check it out. No, Paula says she does, and I would say it depends on who you contact. So, but I want to riff on that. It's not merely enough to verify the facts, it's who you use as a point of reference. So fair and balanced, it depends upon who your references are. You know, the references, the quality of the points of view matter. Informed perspective matters. This isn't a partisan issue, it's not. We're incredibly biased. And by the way, objective journalism is a myth. Objective medicine is a myth. Objective parenting is a myth. We all bring our own biases, and our bias at Mountain Journal is that Bozeman's a pretty damn cool place in a one-of-a-kind ecosystem, and if people want to fault us for being biased and thinking that it's cool and that we need to have a better dialogue to save it, so be it. You know what? You don't have to read us.